Today, let the sunshine in. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 18th of August 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Another week, yet more data, so let's go straight in. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon programme, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. Here is the link, and it's also in the comments below. RBA Governor Philip Lowe appeared before the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics in Canberra this week. He was quite upbeat about the state of the Australian economy, suggesting that wages growth may pick up down the track as unemployment drifts lower. He also said, given that it's not so long ago there was concern in the community about rapidly rising housing prices and debt and declining housing affordability, and that these earlier trends were not sustainable and were posing a medium-term risk to our economy, so a pullback, he said, is a welcome development and it can put the market on a more sustainable footing. In other words, he is embracing home price falls. And he also said that the Royal Commission has shone a light on the issues around the financial sector. Now about
confidence. I think the whole process is really showing the benefit of sunlight, showing a kind of a microscope onto behaviour. I think the community is getting a better understanding and we'll get better outcomes in the financial sector as a result of this.
He said the inquiry had highlighted a lack of trust, a failure of risk management, and just plain bad customer outcomes. The banks need to get back to honesty, integrity, and accountability. And at the end of the latest 2 weeks' hearings in Melbourne, the Royal Commission shone a light on poor practice across the superannuation sector, with some companies taking fees for no service, diverting funds from members' accounts to pay commissions, and other poor practices, some perhaps even illegal. For example, CBA defied a request from APRA to accelerate the transfer of 60,000 members to MySuper in order to placate the bank's aligned advisors. And NAB failed to provide ASIC with up-to-date information about its fees for no service compensation program as the regulator was compiling an industry-wide report on the topic. But the regulators were also caught in the headlights, highlighting the contention and ambiguity between the roles of APRA and ASIC. For example, APRA was waiting for ASIC.
ASIC's responsibility is in relation to potential contraventions of the Corporations Act for the provision of financial advice or potential contraventions under the ASIC Act for retaining money for services for financial advice which aren't provided.
I believe that's correct.
APRA's responsibility is for regulating trustees' compliance with the sole purpose test.
Yes.
So it can't be that the management of this issue is something that should be left to ASIC.
I am not suggesting that we are leaving it to ASIC. I'm saying that we are allowing ASIC to complete its work and review and ensure that the remediation occurs. At an appropriate point, APRA will consider whether there is any further action that we need to take.
Is there some position that APRA has taken as to when in the future will be an appropriate point to consider this issue?
Not at this stage, as far as I'm aware.
So when you say APRA is waiting to see what ASIC will do, has there been any consideration at all within APRA in relation to this issue to date?
There's been discussions with individual entities and on the matter and seeking to get a complete understanding of the issues as they pertain to the individual entities. There would be general discussions occurring at APRA's internal committees about, you know, what the issue was and what was being done to address it and those sorts of things. As I said, I don't believe that we have made any conclusions at this stage as to what further action, if any, we might wish to take.
What about the question of the adequacy of trustee systems for monitoring whether advice services are provided in exchange for the fees that the trustees are debiting from the members' accounts. Is that something that APRA considers?
APRA would look at a range of systems and processes that trustees have in place to monitor particular arrangements. I am not sure that we would necessarily look specifically at advice arrangements. It may be something that we talk with some trustees about as part of our regular supervision activity. It wouldn't be something that we would necessarily look at in all cases.
APRA is not so much a tough cop as a poodle. And ASIC warned that up to $1 billion of restitution was likely to be paid out due to fees for no service.
Our fees for no service project kicked off at around that time, involving, as I think you're probably aware, NAB, the other three banks, and AMP. So it's a very broad-based project, and we contacted all of the major entities around the issue of whether fees had been paid without advice services being provided across their entities, across the different licensees. We've had 27 investigations as part of that project. I think we've collected more than 2.5 million documents. You can see that we've obtained hundreds of millions of dollars so far in remediation and more to come, and so 31 licensees have been part of that project. So it's a very large project, and NAB were certainly very much a key part of that, and remain so.
So far, no proceedings have been commenced in relation to the fees for no service project.
No, so far that is correct. So far, no proceedings have commenced. We've had enforceable undertakings, bannings, and the license condition. I would expect that there is a very high likelihood of proceedings commencing in the near future.
And in terms of the remediation that has occurred so far, that is the entities agreeing to pay back money that they shouldn't have taken in the first place, plus loss of earnings on that money?
Broadly speaking, yes, it's a work in progress. It's a very, very significant project, the remediation project, and we have given that remediation aspect priority. You only have to look at the amounts involved to get a sense of as to why. So I think so far there's been about $260 million paid back, but if you allow for the estimated compensation and the provisions, you're looking at $850 million. It doesn't give me any pleasure to say this, but I wouldn't at all be surprised if it ends up being in excess of $1 billion.
Well, just so we can try to put this in some useful context, this is the return to customers of their money that was first wrongfully taken from them dating back to 2008 or 2009?
Around that time, that's correct.
And so far, the actual compensation that's been paid is about $260 million?
That's right.
And ultimately, you expect that at some time in the future, the total amount will, on the present estimate, be $850 million?
That's right.
So there's only another $790 million to go on the present estimate. I'm sorry, there's only another $590 million to go on the present estimate.
You've done the maths well there, yes.
Well, not the first time. And then, assuming it gets over $1 billion, there'll be another $150 million or so to be reimbursed to those customers?
There could well be. I base that statement on the assumption that there will be entities that are not necessarily part of the big five, so to speak, who may have fees for no service issues. We've already had five or so breach reports from other entities. And it's also the fact that for those the four largest banks in AMP, that they are still working through the amount they will have to pay back, especially in their related licensees. Typically, the work is less advanced in those areas, and that's where there's considerable engagement on ASIC's part.
And has there been any work to assess what profit these entities have made by having deprived customers of their money over this extended period of time?
That's not something that we have sought to do at this point. It's a good question. I think I'd like to say that, I'm happy to say that ASIC will look at that. But I would say up until this point in time, it has been a very, very resource-intensive task to focus on, if you like, the main game, getting money back into the pockets of consumers, and that continues.
In other words, the sector bloated their profits for years thanks to their poor practice at the expense of members. This will have a significant impact ahead, and the market has yet to factor this into their pricing, in our opinion. Then the Commissioner pushed ASIC on the question of whether their approach to enforceable undertakings was the best method and whether ASIC had considered legal proceedings in the past 5 years.
I don't have any further questions for this witness.
Mr. Kell, you've spoken a lot about civil penalty proceedings. Do you regard civil penalty proceedings as the best ultimate means of achieving public denunciation of misconduct?
I think they can be a very effective means, but it will, Commissioner, depend on the circumstances. It might be that criminal proceedings are, in some cases, an appropriate tool. It might be that, in other circumstances, banning someone for life from the industry in which they're working sends a very, very powerful message as well. But certainly I would say that civil penalty proceedings are a very important part of the deterrence toolkit.
If criminal proceedings were to be launched, that would have to be by the Commonwealth DPP, would it not?
That's correct.
And the process would entail ASIC submitting a brief to Commonwealth DPP for consideration by the director whether the circumstances are fit for prosecution?
Indeed.
And do not answer this if the answer would embarrass current considerations, but has ASIC in the last 5 years given consideration to submitting a brief to Commonwealth DPP in respect of any aspect of the fees for no service matter?
Yes.
Mr. Hodge.
Finally, on the Royal Commission, in my discussion with Robert Barwick from the CEC, posted on Friday, he explained that the Senate voted to extend the scope and timing of the commission. So we will see where this goes. You can watch the whole show where we discuss the latest on breaking up the banks. And on that front, there was an interesting article in The Conversation this week by Elizabeth Sheedy, Associate Professor, Financial Risk Management, Macquarie University. She looked at the question of whether bigger banks were better. She said we might assume that economies of scale, reduced costs per unit as output increases, also applies to risk management. The larger the organisation, the more likely it has invested in high-quality, robust risk management systems and staff. If this holds, then a large bank should manage risks more efficiently than a smaller one. The possibility of unexpected operational losses should then be reduced. Larger financial institutions might also attract greater regulatory scrutiny, which might help to improve risk management practices and reduce losses. But in fact, the reverse seems to be true, based on the analysis of American banks from 2001 to 2016. They found for every 1% increase in size, as measured by total assets, there was a 1.2% increase in operational losses. In other words, banks experience diseconomies of scale. And this is particularly driven by the category of clients, products, and business practice. In this category, losses accelerate even faster with the size of the bank. This could be the result of increased complexity in large financial institutions, making risk management more difficult rather than less. As firms grow in size and complexity, it apparently becomes increasingly challenging for senior executives and directors to provide adequate oversight. And this would support the argument that some financial institutions are simply too big to manage, as well as too big to fail. If bigger financial institutions produce worse outcomes for customers, there is an argument for breaking up larger institutions or to intensify regulatory scrutiny, or both. Now, the question is the same thing happening in Australia as in the US? The case studies presented by the Royal Commission suggest it could be, but it's difficult for researchers to know exactly. Australian banks are not required to publicly disclose comprehensive data on operational losses. Whilst APRA may have access to such information, any analysis the regulator may have done is not in the public domain. Another reason to chop the banks into smaller, more manageable and transparent pieces. The economic news this week centred on the employment numbers, with the trend unemployment rate falling marginally from 5.38% to 5.36% in the month of July 2018, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. This continues the gradual decrease in the trend unemployment rate from late 2014 and is the lowest it's been since 2012. Trend employment increased by around 27,000 persons in July, with full-time employment increasing by over 18,000 persons. The trend participation rate remained steady at 65.5% for July 2018, after the June figure was revised down. Over the past year, trend employment increased by around 300,000 persons, or 2.4%, which was above the average year-on-year growth over the past 20 years at 2%. The trend monthly hours worked increased by 0.2% in July 2018 and by 1.9% over the past year. For most states and territories, year-on-year growth in trend employment was above their 20-year average, except for Queensland, Western Australia, and Tasmania. Over the past year, the states and territories with the strongest annual growth in trend employment was the Northern Territory at 3.5%, New South Wales at 3.2%, and Victoria at 2.5%. So my read on all this is that after strong trends in the first half of the year, the labour market does appear to be softening, with falling trend hours worked, falling trend job growth, and falling trend full-time jobs growth. Frankly, it appears that there is significant slack in the labour market, which means wages growth will likely remain constrained. And on this, the ABS reported that the seasonally adjusted wage price index rose 0.6% in June 2018 and 2.1% through the year, with seasonally adjusted private sector wages going up 2% and public sector wages growing 2.4% through the year to the June quarter 2018. The trend data tracks a similar path, with public sector wages growing consistently stronger than the private sector. In original terms, though, the year wage growth to the June quarter 2018 ranged from 1.3% for the mining industry to 2.7% for the healthcare and social assistance industry. And Western Australia and the Northern Territory both recorded the lowest through the year wage growth of 1.3 and 1.4% respectively, while Victoria and Tasmania record the highest at 2.3% and New South Wales was 2.1%. This wages pressure also came through in our post on household financial confidence, which we released this week. The latest edition of the DFA Household Financial Confidence Index to the end of July 2018 remains in below average territory, coming in at 89.6 compared with 89.7 last month. We had expected a bounce this month, and in fact the rate of decline did slow thanks to small pay rises for some in the new financial year and refinancing of some mortgage loans to the special rates on offer currently. However, the index at this level is associated with households keeping their discretionary spending firmly under control. And the property grind is still impacting severely. Looking at the results by our property segmentation, owner-occupied households overall remained around the neutral reading, while property investor confidence continues to fall into territory normally associated with those who are renting or living with family. This signals significant risk in the property investment sector ahead. There was a small rise in those reporting an income improvement, thanks for changes which kicked in from July. 2.3% said their income had improved, up 1.5% from last month, while 43.7% stayed the same, and there was a drop of 2.2% of those reporting a fall in income to 50.5%. However, households continue to see the cost of living rising, with 82.3% reporting higher costs, up 1%, 13% reported no change, and 2.5% falling. The usual suspects, including power bills, childcare costs, the price of fuel, plus healthcare costs, and the latest round of council rate demands, all came into play. The reported CPI appears to continue to underreport the real experiences of many households, and many continue to dip into savings to pay the bills. So finally, putting this all together, the proportion of households who reported their net worth was higher than a year ago continues to slide as property price falls continue to hit home, and as savings are raided to maintain a lifestyle. 42% said their net worth had improved, down 3.75% from last month. 25.6% said their net worth had fallen, up 2.5%. And 28% reported no real change. And you can watch our separate show on our analysis, Household Financial Confidence Grinds Lower Again. The latest S&P Ratings Spin Index showed another rise in mortgage delinquencies in their monthly series to June 2018. The overall score remained at 1.38, but of note in particular is the rise in more than 90-day defaults, which is consistent with other data we've seen, up from 0.67 to 0.70 from May. And in the AFR, Chris Joy argued that this measure may understate the true arrears profile because of the way the securitised pool is managed. His own estimates were higher, with a consistent set of rises through the year, again underscoring the pressure on households. And turning to the markets, the ASX 200 ended the week at 6,339, up 0.17%, and it's now visiting territory not seen since before the GFC. Perhaps an ominous sign. CBA, the largest owner-occupied mortgage lender, ended the week at 74.29 on Friday, up 0.23%, and NAB rose 0.17% to 28.85, despite the prospect of criminal proceedings relating to fee for no service. The Aussie closed at 73.17 to the US dollar, up a bit from its lows, but the trend is still lower over the year. We'll be importing inflation at these levels. In the US markets, the Dow Jones Industrial ended the week at 25,669, up 0.43% on Friday. The Fear Index, the VIX, also calmed down, falling 6% to 12.64 after some market nerves were calmed. The earnings calendar began to lighten up this week, but there were still enough major reports to move the US market, especially in the retail sector. The broader market tends to perform well if retail is humming along, as consumer spending accounts for as much as 70% of US economic growth. Walmart reported quarterly earnings that topped consensus and raised its full-year earnings guidance, ended at $97.85. Home Depot lifted its full-year guidance for both revenue and same-store sales, but Macy's shares struggled on margin concerns. In tech, Cisco Systems beat on both the top and bottom lines, and the company forecast better than expected numbers for its fiscal first quarter, and so ended up 1.57% to $45.87. The Nasdaq ended at 7,816, up 0.13%. Talks of trade rapprochement between the US and China helped ease the nagging tariff tensions in stocks. China said it would hold a fresh round of trade talks with the US in Washington later this month, offering a glimmer of hope for progress in resolving a conflict that has set world markets on edge. A Chinese delegation, led by their Vice Minister of Commerce, will meet with US representatives led by Undersecretary of Treasury for International Affairs, the Ministry of Commerce said in a statement on its website. The upcoming meeting, which is lower level compared with four previous rounds of talks, comes at the invitation of the US, according to the statement. The Turkish lira took currency traders on another wild ride this week, keeping bank stocks, especially in Europe, on the back foot. The struggling currency sank to an all-time low of 7.2393 on Monday, amid growing concern over a deepening diplomatic rift with the United States over Ankara's detention of Andrew Brinson, an American pastor detained in 2016. It found its footings on Tuesday after the country's central bank pledged to provide liquidity in response to the meltdown. And then on Friday, Turkey remained in the spotlight as US Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin announced that the US is prepared to slap Turkey with more sanctions if its president refuses the quick release of Brunson. The Turkish lira has lost almost half of its value this year, largely over worries about Erdogan's growing influence over the economy. His repeated calls for lower interest rates in the face of high inflation and worsening ties with the US. It ended at 60.175, up 3.15%. Wall Street dealt with mixed economic data over the week. On Friday, the University of Michigan reported a drop in its preliminary measure of August consumer sentiment, which surprised the market. The measure of 95.3 was down from July. Economists were looking for a rise to 98.1. But July retail sales and core retail sales, which exclude autos, came in above expectations. Housing data was mixed. Housing starts for July rose less than economists anticipated, but building permits, an indicator of future demand, were stronger than forecast for the month. The Philadelphia Federal Reserve said its manufacturing index fell by 14 points to 11.9 from 25.7 in July, and the consensus forecast had been for a reading of 21.9. Gold prices were on track for their biggest weekly loss since April 2017, as worries about demand from China and contagion from Turkey's currency crisis. And gold was also hit by strength in the dollar, as a stronger greenback makes gold more expensive to holders of foreign currency, but again rose a little on Friday to 1,191, still well down across the year, as the US dollar takes center stage in terms of a risk hedge. Copper fell into bear market territory during the week, but then recovered a little to 266. In China, data showed fixed asset investments rose less than anticipated, as did factory output. And copper prices sank on indications of China's weakness and were hit by easing supply concerns. BHP Billiton and the union at the world's biggest mine in Chile agreed to put a new wage offer to a vote by workers, potentially saving the industry from a strike that threatened to disrupt supply at a time of shrinking stockpiles. And looking at Bitcoin, there was a small rise, up 3.69% on Friday to 6,607, but the bears are still stalking the halls. The 10-year bond yield was down this week to 2.864, but the gap between the short and long-term rates is still tighter, suggesting that a US recession may be on the cards later. And we discussed this in our post, What Does a Yield Curve Inversion Really Signal? And so is the local property market. With auction clearance rates and mortgage lending in the doldrums, it's of no surprise to see that the latest CoreLogic data showing that the combined effect of low rental yields and declining dwelling values has resulted in a rapid reduction in overall returns from housing over the past year. Their total returns index is similar to the ASX 200 accumulation index in that it measures overall housing market returns. To do this, it measures annual value changes along with annualized growth rental yields to provide the total picture on typical housing returns. The returns have been achieved via capital gains rather than rental income. With dwelling values now falling and gross rental yields close to historic lows, the total returns from residential housing are not looking so attractive, and a greater share of returns are coming from the yield component. With national dwelling values having fallen by minus 1.6% over the 12 months to July 2018, total annual returns have fallen to just 1.9%, which is the lowest they've been since June 2012. The fall in total returns has been substantial, given that a year earlier total returns were recorded at 14.2%. Across the combined capital cities, total returns over the 12 months to July 2018 were recorded 0.8%, which was the lowest they've been since May 2012. And total returns across the combined regional markets were recorded at 6.6% over the past year, which was the lowest they've been since June 2013. Over the past 12 months, total returns in Sydney have fallen by 2.5%, and the 2.5% fall in returns over the year is the weakest result since February 2009 and is a substantial slowdown in annual returns from July 2017 when it increased by 19%. With dwelling values falling 5.4% in Sydney over the past year, it highlights that value changes largely dictate total returns in Sydney. In regional New South Wales, total returns increased by 6.7% over the past year, which was the smallest annual increase since February 2013. And annual returns in regional New South Wales have slowed from 17.1%. And so to the Housing Industry Association, which continues to discuss a simple demand-supply equation for property prices, when in fact our analysis suggests it is credit supply, which is the real lever of price growth. As credit is tightening and the supply of property is booming, whichever lever we look at, it suggests prices will continue to fall and further than many are predicting. The HIA said, housing affordability is all about supply and demand. And for most of this century, there have been constraints on new home building that have limited supply and forced up prices. Since 2014, Australia has built an unprecedented volume of new homes, and we are starting to see affordability indicators improve. The fall in house prices in Sydney and Melbourne is one indicator that affordability is improving, but the stalling of rental price inflation in the June quarter this year is the most important indicator. It tells us that the pent-up demand for new housing in Sydney and Melbourne is beginning to be met with a record volume of new housing. The fall in house prices will dampen demand for new housing over the next 12 months. And also, they said, the proliferation of punitive taxes on investors in the housing market, disincentives to overseas buyers, and tighter oversight of mortgage lending for home purchase, and the environment for residential building is facing significant challenges. They said, for these reasons, we expect that the housing market will cool over the next couple of years, but the down cycle that has emerged in certain segments of the market and locations will, they say, be moderate. Well, we agree the market is falling, but the tighter credit will drive prices lower still. Indeed, the effect is being felt in the previously booming Hobart market, according to CoreLogic. Over the 3 years to July 2018, Hobart dwelling values increased by 32.4%, which is a significantly greater increase in values than Melbourne, the city with the second largest increase in values over the same period, in which values increased by 18.7%. The latest quarterly data shows that values increased by 1.1% over the 3 months to July 2018, and that's the slowest rate of quarterly growth since July 2016. Furthermore, although dwelling values are 11.5% higher over the past 12 months, which makes Hobart the region with the nation's strongest value growth, it was the slowest annual rate of growth for the city since February 2017. The trends in the data are certainly pointing to some weakness starting to appear in the Hobart market. In addition, belatedly, dwelling approvals are now starting to trend much higher, indicating that supply is starting to increase, which should also have an impact on the rate of value growth in the city. Which takes us nicely to our upcoming live stream event on Tuesday. Mark Kidari, the next DFA live stream event, will be on Tuesday, the 21st of August at 8 p.m. Sydney time. We'll be updating our four scenarios, looking at the prospect for home prices and the broader economy over the next 3 years. It's already scheduled on the channel if you want to set a reminder. And I hope to see you there in the live chat. But also feel free to send questions in beforehand if that's easier. If you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. As always, if you like what you've heard here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. And if you want to join the growing band as subscribers so you receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst of Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.